This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it is Monday with the mayor. We have Acting Mayor Kim Janey on the line. Mayor Janey, welcome back to Radio Boston, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you, and I understand you are taking calls. So listeners, do you live or work in Boston? Do you have a question for Mayor Janey? Call us 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So Mayor Janey, before we begin, I wonder if anybody knows what it's like to be in your shoes right now or in the last few weeks. How are you?
I am doing well. I am continuing my focus on the people of Boston. As mayor of this city, this great city, we are still dealing with a global pandemic and a number of challenges facing Boston, as well as so many other cities and towns across our Commonwealth and country, and my priority continues to be with the people.
So you're here as acting mayor, one who's been serving since March, whose tenure will end in November. Last couple of times you were here as a candidate, and we'll get to that later because I do want to talk about the transition. But right now, I want to start with the mayoralty and some news of the day on COVID, because Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine, the company has said that it's safe and effective in clinical trials for kids ages 5 to 12. They're going to seek federal emergency use authorization. How important is that to the safety and the well-being, both physically and overall, of the people of Boston?
Well, it's a huge milestone, but to caution folks, we're still not there yet. This is just the trial results, and so we still need FDA approval to move forward with that. But I'm very hopeful that we will get there, and we will roll out a plan so that we can get our youngest children vaccinated. It is critically important, as we have children in our schools who are not even eligible for the vaccine. And so now that we will hopefully very soon be able to reach out to them and target them and their families, we will do so. The vaccine, I will continue to stress, is the most effective tool to fighting COVID. And we can see it when we look at who is in the hospital, who has died from COVID. It's very clear. It's unvaccinated folks. And so we have to do everything we can to get everyone in our city the life-saving vaccine.
So right now, that vaccine is not mandated in Boston public schools. And as you noted, a lot of kids not eligible. But we hope they will become eligible. And as that is the case, do you anticipate that there might be a time where there's a vaccine mandate for students?
There may be, you know, that would be, again, left to the Department of Education. That would be left to folks at the state, at the federal level. Right now, we are doing all we can to keep our kids safe, and that has meant a testing protocol. That's meant investment in HVAC. That has been the first in the Commonwealth to implement a mask mandate for our schools. And as you may know, we are in the first day for vaccine verification for our city workers, and our school staff are in that first cohort.
Yeah, how's that going? Have you heard?
It's good. It's encouraging. Well, we still have till the end of the day for folks to verify their vaccination status, but the numbers have been growing throughout the day, so that's encouraging. We know that many folks who are in this, and I should mention who they are, it's our schools, it is our libraries, it's Age Strong, it's the Disability Commission, and it is BCYF. Those are the first five that have to upload their vaccine verification status or be subjected to weekly testing.
If they don't upload that status today, just the nuts and bolts of this a little bit, because we're on the front end of this now. How long do they have to submit that negative test? Does that have to have been submitted today as well?
No, that will be a week. So they have a week to do that when they'll start that. But the goal is to get everyone to upload their vaccination, that they are fully vaccinated. And so that's what we hope to see. But those who choose not to, we'll have to go through weekly testing. And those who refuse weekly testing will be put on unpaid administrative leave.
We have a lot of questions for Mayor Kim Janey. What are yours? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So staying on education and COVID for a minute, the Massachusetts Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, or DESE, released its first COVID case report of the year last week. The data show that Boston, Worcester, and Springfield schools logged the highest number of staff cases, with 8 each. Are you thinking that with this new policy in place, are you expecting to see that number come down, and how quickly?
Well, we want to get everyone vaccinated. We want to get our school staff. We want to get children who are eligible to receive the vaccine, vaccinated, their families. It's why we've had, as part of our back-to-school work, linking up with mobile vaccination clinics. Many of the back-to-school events had these clinics right there so that people could choose to get vaccinated. We know, though, there will be cases in schools, and that is why there is a testing policy that involves CIC Health and Boston Medical Center to make sure that we can isolate any cases, support that student or adult who may test positive while they are away, certainly test and stay for other school children so that they can continue their learning. We know that this year and a half has been so difficult for our children in particular and their families, that there is learning loss that happened, you know, despite everyone working hard with remote learning. That can never take the place of children being in the classroom with their teachers, with their peers. And so we cannot continue down that road. We know we've got to have school children back in the classroom to make up for that lost time and get them on the road to academic success.
So I want to pick up on that for a minute and talk about school buses. Governor Baker has activated the National Guard to provide drivers to districts that need it. About 120 drivers were trained as of last week, and we've got districts from Chelsea, Revere, Quincy, Lowell, Worcester that have accepted help. Boston is not taking that offer. Why?
Well, I mean, it's we have done pretty good thus far. I'm really proud that today we're at 90%. On Friday we were at 90%. We've had the best on our very first day. We beat the five-year average, and we did that in a pandemic. We did that on a rainy school day. We've been doing the work to make sure that every single bus route is covered. And so if there are other districts that need more support, they should certainly get that. If we get to the point where we need more support because we're, you know, continue to lack drivers, or, you know, God forbid, drivers test positive for COVID or anything, we certainly want to take advantage of any help that is out there. But we've have done a great job in getting on-time arrival in terms of students getting to school, as well as that first day of attendance. We broke the record.
How do you get the other 10%? And listen, I recognize, I mean, on day one it was 57%, the day two, 81%. Now you're at 90. I know, you know, from preparing for previous conversations, that that's not bad in comparison to pre-COVID. But how do you get the other 10%?
Well, they're you know, will continue to be a challenge given the shortage, which is why we are doing everything to make sure that the routes are covered, that we have backup drivers. We want always to get all of our kids to school on time. And we know in a city like Boston with old roads and lots of traffic that that can be a challenge. And so, you know, this means that we've got to focus on other things, not just our school buses, but traffic flow throughout our city, and making sure that we have the infrastructure in place for multimodal transportation. That means dedicated bus lanes. That means looking at dedicated bus lanes for our school buses, not just our public transportation buses. All of those things are on the table for how we can continue to improve our on-time arrival and ensure that all of our kids can maximize their time in the classroom with their teachers.
Let's talk about housing for a little bit, and I'm focused on the eviction moratorium that you put in place last month. There's been, you know, pushback from developers and landlord groups like the Small Property Owners Association. Do you believe and do you hope that Boston's next mayor will continue the policy? And is there anything that you want to do now to ensure that that policy continues?
Well, it certainly needs to continue for the foreseeable future as we continue to battle this pandemic. And we see this economic downturn. When it comes to those who need extra help in paying their rent, that is what the Rental Relief Fund is for. So when I first came into office, I invested $50 million in this fund. This fund goes to support not just tenants but landlords alike who could take advantage of this fund. We've been able to help 3,400 families stay in their homes, so we've had a lot of success there. More than that, we've got a foreclosure prevention fund, because it's not just tenants who are having a difficult time. There are people who own their homes who are having a difficult time. And so we want to do everything we can to keep people in their homes and make sure that Boston is a place where if people want to come and put down roots, they're able to do that. It's why the housing agenda also quadrupled the down payment assistance for first-time homebuyers, taking that from $10,000 to $40,000. So the housing agenda is more than an eviction moratorium, but I would suggest to the next mayor of Boston that this eviction moratorium should be in place till the end of the calendar year for sure.
I think about the numbers that you've just given, and they're important, and yet we also know the size and the magnitude of the challenge around housing, especially affordable housing, you know, addressing gentrification, making sure that generations of families, as you did, can, right, grow up and then live in the same neighborhood. Is there anything else that you feel a sense of urgency to put in place during the remainder of your term to try to address what feels like one of the gnarliest issues facing the city right now?
Yeah, I think home ownership is something that we really have to look at, particularly as it relates to communities of color, specifically the Black and Latino community. Communities that have historically been left out need a real opportunity to break the cycle of poverty and build generational wealth in the city. When we think about the racial wealth gap here in the city of Boston, we know that wealth is created through ownership, whether business ownership or home ownership. And so much more needs to be done around ownership in Boston. And, you know, we have planted some good seeds and laid the groundwork for some of that with the down payment assistance that I just talked about, taking that from $10,000 to $40,000. But there's also real opportunity with the ARP funding to look at this issue with other monies that are coming, and then just through policy. And so we will continue over these next 2 months to again prioritize the people of Boston during my tenure as mayor, and I would encourage the next mayor to lift this up as well. Home ownership is going to be critically important in stabilizing our city and dealing with the wealth gap and making sure that the people who want to call Boston home can do so for generations to come.
1-800-423-8255 to join this conversation. I was going to do this a little later in this discussion, Mayor Janey, but because you just emphasized the racial wealth gap, because you talked about the populations in Boston who are most vulnerable on housing, who are most behind compared to white Bostonians in terms of wealth and assets, we are in this moment where we had three Black candidates running for mayor. You're the first Black leader in the mayor's seat in Boston. And we're now going forward with two candidates who are not Black and are going to need to make a case to our Black and brown communities about hearing their issues, about being responsive to their needs, being present in the neighborhoods. They're both women of color, but how are you thinking about that today?
Well, again, my priority is to look to the people of Boston to make sure that they're okay. And so for what I can do in this moment now is ensure a smooth transition of power to the next mayor, who, as you rightly say, is going to be a woman of color. And it is also true that they will have to pick up that mantle and ensure that this city works for everyone, that this city, that it's not leaving anyone behind. And so that will be true of any mayor who sits in this office. And so I am very proud of what I've been able to do as the first woman mayor, as the first black mayor for our city, to move Boston forward, to make sure we were dealing with racial justice issues, racial equity issues. And it is certainly my hope that the next mayor will do the same.
Let's talk about that transition a little bit. It's not, you know, like with the presidential election, where there's an election in the beginning of November and then you've got till January, right? The swearing in will be sometime in November. Swearing in, it's 10 days to 2 weeks after the election is certified. How do you plan for and prepare for that transition in a way that minimizes sort of bumps and bruises both for the next mayor, but also for the policies you've been working to put in place over the last 6 months?
Yeah, well, we start now. And so I am in communication with both Councilor Wu and Councilor Asabi George, and certainly wish them well over the next few weeks. But we start those conversations now, and you know, I've already directed my cabinet to begin that process, and so we will start this work now in terms of just laying out some of the basics. Once there is someone who emerges from November 2nd, we'll go deeper into a transition process, but we're going to start right now. We're not going to wait until, you know, they come and I leave. We're going to start that process right now.
One more thing on that, and then we'll move on. You know, voting data analyzed by WBUR showed that in the preliminary, you drew strong support in majority-minority precincts in the heart of the city, Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, Hyde Park. In fact, you drew far more support than the other candidates in precincts that are less than 20% white. There are two candidates you've worked with, you've known for a long time. You've worked side by side. What advice would you give them? What messages do they need to bring forward? How do they need to show up for the voters who supported you to earn their trust in the general?
Well, again, I'm gonna leave all of this analysis for the pundits. I'm going to stay focused on the people of Boston. As I said, you know, it is incumbent upon any mayor to make sure that they are addressing racial equity, racial justice issues. So I don't know that I'll add more to what I've already said, other than, you know, my commitment is ensuring a smooth transition. It's what the people of Boston need. We are still in the midst of a global pandemic. We are still in the midst of a housing crisis. There are a number of challenges facing our city. And I want the next mayor to be ready to lead on day one. And to, again, be able to prioritize the people of Boston, particularly those who have been left out historically. This city is a great city, and it's a city that must and should work for every single resident in every single neighborhood.
Yeah, I hear you. And I want to be clear, I'm not trying to be cute with this. I just am so aware that you are in a moment where you are connected to the residents of Boston in a way that's unlike almost anyone else. And over 6 months, you've learned what the residents of Boston need to hear. So let me put it to you this way. Today, from you as the mayor, what do residents of Boston most need to hear from you right now?
Well, they need leadership who continues to prioritize the people. We are in the midst of a pandemic. We are going into flu season during this pandemic with college kids back, with students in our schools. We still have a housing crisis. We still have a number of challenges facing our city. And it is important that we get beyond politics and ensure that we are coming together as a city to deal with very tough issues that have been in the making for years and decades. Many of the things, as I've said a number of times, that COVID has illuminated have been here under the surface the whole time. And so as we continue to fight COVID-19 in terms of cases and slowing the spread, we've also have to address the systemic inequities that have been there all along. And so it is very important that we come together to do that work. That isn't the work that one person does by themselves. That is the work that we as a city have to do together. And so I am very proud of the work that I've been able to do over the last 6 months and will continue to do over the next 2 months to continue to move Boston forward, to make sure that there is a foundation from which to build, and to make sure that I am available for the next mayor to, again, make sure that the people of our city in every single neighborhood all across Boston are well served.
Let's take a call. Let's take one from Abdi in East Boston. Abdi, you are on with Mayor Kim Janey.
Thank you, Atisiana, longtime listener, first-time caller. Good afternoon, and good afternoon to the mayor as well. Thank you for your service and your historic run. I was just curious, you have done a really good work so far, and I was curious if our city, under your tenure, will announce Indigenous Peoples Day as a city holiday. I think we are the last city. Our neighbor cities, Cambridge, Somerville, and Newton have done it, and I was curious if you will make a historic announcement for this coming holiday.
Thank you, Abdi. That is a great question, and that is something that my team and I are working on. I really appreciate you lifting that up, and I think very timely, especially given the conversation.
So are you working towards doing that before you're done in the mayor's office?
Yes.
Let's take one more call from Mary in Southend. Mary, go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you, Mayor Janey, for your service and City Council. I am a long-term resident of the South End. My children went school busing at the same time that you did. And we knew your father very well at the Bancroft School, and everybody adored him, as you know.
Thank you, Mary.
We do appreciate what you're doing, and I like your ideas tremendously. What I'm calling about is something that we in the South End are going through, but we're not the only neighborhood in the city. It's happening to South Boston. I suspect it's happening in Roxbury and Roslindale and everywhere. As the real estate prices skyrocket, the new people coming in with a great deal of money to build, to buy houses and renovate them, the real estate taxes go up. So those of us who bought into the South End, and I think you may have been living there when we bought in the South End, and we chose the South End because of...
So, Mary, I am so sorry to interrupt you, and I don't mean to disrespect you, but the mayor has limited remaining time with us, and I want to make sure she can address the issue of real estate taxes. So let me allow the mayor to respond.
Mary, it's so good to hear from you. I'm not sure exactly what your question was. I assume it has to do with the property values going up and therefore real estate taxes going up.
Yes.
And, you know, this is a huge issue. And it's a huge issue not just for the individual taxpayer. It's an issue for our city as a whole because so much of our city's budget is dependent upon real estate taxes. In fact, 3/4 of our budget is on real estate tax. And so we have to diversify our revenue stream. This, again, is going to fall to so few people are paying into the real estate tax. So few homeowners are here, and yet... our budget is largely dependent upon it. And so we do have to address this moving forward in a way that diversifies our revenue stream. I do have a piece of legislation right now that is currently at the State House that would help generate millions of dollars that could then be invested in affordable housing. And this is through a transfer fee that would take a small percentage of from the buyer and the seller for properties that sell on the high end, so that we're protecting small landlords and dealing with those who are utilizing the housing market as some sort of speculative market for their own individual gain. And so the hope is that we can get that passed to help diversify our revenue stream and support housing in the city that meets the needs of residents here in Boston.
And Mary,
and
again,
I do appreciate call Mary, and especially the reference to my dad. So thank you so much.
That was heartening. And again, Mary, sorry to cut you off, but we are up against the mayor's next appointment. And with that in mind, Boston Acting Mayor Kim Janey, I want to thank you for joining us. And I hope you will come back one more time, do one more Monday
Absolutely.
With us.
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure. I certainly appreciate you and all of your listeners. Thank you so much.
If we told you about a massive vaccination effort underway on Cape Cod last week in this, I doubt you would guess that we were talking about raccoons. Well, actually, you might guess, because we spoke with wildlife biologist Brian Bjorkland back in July as on-the-ground and aerial rabies vaccine efforts for raccoons began on the Cape. And this is actually pretty fascinating stuff, folks. So that effort wrapped up the same month, but this fall, out of an abundance of caution, they started it again. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of rabies vaccine doses on the ground and by helicopter. It is now the largest rabies inoculation effort in state history. So we've asked Brian Bjorkland back, wildlife and rabies biologist, Cape Cod Rabies Program Coordinator with the USDA. Brian, welcome back.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So you're out in the field right now getting vaccines to raccoons. How's that working today? Where are you? What are you doing today? How does it physically work?
So I'm actually back in my office right now, but I had been working in Falmouth and on Joint Base Cape Cod, distributing these oral rabies vaccine baits in areas where coyotes and raccoons and foxes are likely to come across them. We do have several other town and county employees that are out as we speak distributing these baits across the landscape in Falmouth, Mashpee, Barnstable, Yarmouth, Dennis, Chatham, and Harwich, and we'll be doing so for the remainder of the week.
And so you put this stuff out there. You're dropping it literally from the sky, and you're scattering it on the ground. How do you know, and I'm chuckling at the coyotes, raccoons, and foxes, oh my, kind of rhythm of that, but how do you know they're eating them?
Yep, so the aerial operations actually concluded last Thursday. So we baited from Lakeville in Plymouth County out to Orleans on the Cape between Monday and Thursday, and we distributed roughly 100,000 of these baits from air. And we were flying at about 300 feet, so we're able to pretty much pinpoint where these baits are going and access areas that we can't really get to from the ground. And then this week we're focused on ground operations, so baiting in areas where we couldn't really, fly to get these baits out. Too many people and their pets on the landscape.
So, are you sure the animals are going to eat them? And second, what happens if the pets eat them?
Yep, so first, I'll answer your second question first. So the baits are generally considered safe for pets and people. If your dog were to consume one or more of the baits, he or she may experience an upset stomach from the fish meal coating on the outside of the bait, but they have a long track record of being very, very safe for people and their pets. And each bait is stamped with an 800 number that we request that if somebody were to find the bait, to call just to report, where they found the animal. But then once this whole operation is wrapped up, USDA will return to the areas where we put the baits out and live trap raccoons and other rabies vectors to take some blood samples and see what the vaccination rates were as a result of the bait distribution.
All right. So I got to ask you, we are talking about, I'm sorry, what feels to me as a layperson to be a massive vaccination effort here. Why? Is it because rabies is fatal to mammals if they get it and they can't get treated? Is it because I was shocked to discover that there was actually a time when terrestrial animals, not in my lifetime, actually didn't have rabies in Massachusetts? Why are we doing this?
Sure. So as you mentioned, the rabies virus is nearly 100% fatal if not treated. In Massachusetts, raccoon rabies was first discovered in 1992, and that prompted representatives from down on the Cape, Tufts University, and the Centers for Disease Control to set up this program to see what they could do to prevent rabies from eventually getting to the Cape, and that held true for over 10 years. But then in 2004, we found a rabid raccoon in Bourne, just over the canal, and despite our best efforts to prevent it from spreading all the way to Provincetown, it did within 2 years. So since then, we had been working really hard to get rabies back off the Cape, and we went over 8 years without having a single case of terrestrial-based, so raccoon-based rabies on the Cape. And that was really outstanding, and it was tremendously successful. This past May, we documented our first case in Hyannis in over 8 years, and that prompted this whole effort to make sure that we snuff out whatever is out there on the Cape so that we don't, you know, relive what we had experienced back in 2004.
So I just want to clarify for listeners, aerial being bats versus terrestrial
beings.
Right, right. All right, so last question for you. You know, I kind of imagine something sort of Apocalypse Now with the bait falling from the sky and the helicopters and being spread across the ground. Is this like the new normal? Am I going to be talking to you next year about the hundreds of thousands of vaccines you're going to be spreading?
So we have done this, conducted this distribution program twice annually for the past, well, at least since 2005. So it's not really a new program, but to this extent where we're baiting from Lakeville to Orleans, that's somewhat new, and that's in response to that case that we had in Hyannis. We're not really sure what we're going to be doing next spring. It really depends on, you know, rabies surveillance results and if any other cases arise, you know, on the Cape. So I can't really tell you what the plans are for next year.
We'll have to check in with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Brian Bjorklund is a wildlife and rabies biologist and the Cape Cod Rabies Program Coordinator with the USDA. Brian, great to talk to you. Thanks for coming back and joining us.
Thank you very much.
Starting tonight, Mount Auburn Cemetery will host a reunion of sorts. Patrick Gabrich, the producing artistic director for Plays in Place, is the former artist in residence of Mount Auburn Cemetery. And while in that role, he wrote Moonlight Abolitionists. It is a play featuring six of the abolitionists who are buried there. That production will be performed in the cemetery over the next 3 nights under the full moon.
And what's fun about this play is not just what they're talking about, but where and how it's happening. So this play is staged as a concert reading, which means the actors are at music stands and they have scripts with them, but they're in the dark. This is an outdoor play intended to be staged under the full moon, written very specifically for that. So they have lights on their music stands, but it's kind of dark and you're out in the cemetery at night. And this setup of the play is such that they're kind of meet under every full moon and kind of retell their stories as a way of kind of keeping from fading completely into the shadows. And I was really thinking about, you know, what does it make us think about? What is it like when you're out in the cemetery under the full moon? You know, some people could kind of feel like, oh, being in a cemetery at night can be a little scary. And it is if you think in terms of cemeteries as like horror movie kind of things, but it's a very peaceful, serene place with birds and insect sounds, just whether it's daytime or nighttime. And that sense of it pervades even under the full moon. So it has this really special place. And I wanted to take advantage of that and then really get a sense of these people gathering and this kind of conjuring in a way.
Patrick was inspired to write the play when he stumbled across a monument dedicated to Charles Turner Torrey, and he decided to learn more.
He is someone who was kind of not a success as a minister. He'd lost a couple jobs because he was too obsessed with abolition, trying to be a reporter, but wanted to take direct action. So partnered with a black partner, Thomas Smallwood, who was born into slavery, freed himself at age 30 by buying his freedom. And they decided to start helping slaves escape. And this is not what abolitionists did. You know, they would help people who had already escaped, but they didn't encourage them. They weren't sure the morality of that, actually, which is fascinating to me. So, and they didn't want to just do it one at a time. They wanted to hurt the institution of slavery. So they would take a wagon full of people who were enslaved, 8, 10, 12 people at a time. They managed to free, in the period of about 2 years, somewhere in the neighborhood of 400 slaves. which is just astonishing. Harriet Tubman, who's probably kind of one of the most influential people we know about in the Underground Railway movement, freed about 80 in her lifetime.
Now, so much of Patrick's work is inspired by and a celebration of place, the place, Mount Auburn Cemetery. So we wanted to revisit part of a conversation that Radio Boston's Chris Siderick had with Gaybridge in Mount Auburn Cemetery back in 2019 when he was showcasing the nature plays.
I was down here before knocking water off the chairs and like five frogs just jumped in the water.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, got a lot of company out here. And the other day we were doing a show. There was a hawk, Cooper's hawk, eating its lunch over there, and the chipmunks are just going crazy around here. They're deep, 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 putting out the alarm call all throughout our place. That's crazy.
It's an incredible place here. I'd lived in the city for a long time, never really came down to check it out.
I think that's one of the big pluses of doing this kind of work and why my company, Plays in Place, is so interested in getting involved with working with museums and historic sites. Because we saw that with Blood on the Snow when we did the show over at the Old State House, and that's right downtown. And I talked to people who'd like, I've lived here my whole life, and I didn't even know you could go inside.
Yeah.
And they're like,
and
yeah.
It's huge. I mean, you just can wander around and get lost here.
And it's so beautiful, and it's free and open to just come on in, but it's the history and the nature. It's a world-class arboretum. So it has got so many things going for it, which made it a really difficult project to write about.
Yeah, I mean, that after the plays last night, I kind of took the long way out and just kind of wandered around a little bit, and I stumbled across the Longfellow family tombstones, and there's so many people buried here, the Gardner family, you've got multiple Supreme Court justices. So when you decide, okay, I want to tell some stories about this place and the people and really try to capture it, some of your plays, you have a play about salamanders, a play about mushrooms, trees. How did you land on the themes that you ended up deciding to write about?
Exactly. Yeah, I spent a whole year trying to figure out what are the things we're going to write about. But it became clear quickly that they're kind of the two main strengths are the history and the resonance, but also the natural environment. And the institution here is really dedicated to that. So they have like a wildlife manager, and there's so many staff members that are involved in maintaining this place. And I really wanted to get to that heart of things. And so some things made sense right away, because the bird watchers are a big presence here in the spring. So I went to 6:30 in the morning bird walks. And I had already been a bit of a birder, but trying to understand kind of what the culture is around that. That's the other thing about writing plays in the cemetery is anytime you're writing plays, you're writing about people. So even salamanders aren't really about salamanders.
Right.
It's about people and how they interact and how we're dealing with a world that is sometimes frightening and changing, and what can we do about it.
Yeah, so we're standing at the spot where the salamander play takes place, the first of the five plays. And, I mean, you're surrounded by these beautiful purple flowers and consecration dell, and as the salamanders refer to it. In the play, you have two salamanders who meet up for the first time and are exploring this potential mating ritual. And we've got a little bit of tape of that, so we'll listen to that here.
I'm not sure if I'm going to lay eggs this season.
Oh, come on! What did I do now? I said all the right things, and I meant them. You've got my heart pounding so fast it's making me dizzy.
It's not you. It's the world. I don't think it's fair to bring babies into this world.
But we can try.
I was really struck by there's humor in the play, but there's also this theme of two people trying to explore modern dating, and also this fear of bringing children into a scary world. I'm a father of two young kids, and to me that really was a powerful moment. I think it's a question that a lot of people are grappling with right now. How are you thinking about that as you wrote that play?
You know, you start from some point, and I had been talking to people about the salamanders that are here and how they're kind of rare, and their mating habits are a little unusual. So I was kind of curious about that. But then once you start thinking about all the implications of what does it make to make new creatures and how do we all relate to the world, that just kind of led that way. And I think I'm interested in those big questions. But I want plays that are first engaging people, so the humor and drama that you are, and then allows us to ask big questions later.
So let's maybe walk to the next spot.
Go to Namesakes. One of the challenges, I think, for radio is that I wish people could see what we see today. You couldn't recreate this in a theater. And that's one thing I love about being outside, is that we can have a backdrop that allows us to explore things both thematically and also just the visually that we can have, that we don't have to create it. It's there.
Professor Agassiz.
Professor Gray, this is exactly how I expected to find you.
My curiosity for the world cannot be quenched.
A quality we share. I brought you something.
What is it?
If I told you, it would spoil your fun.
You were always perceptive. Not always correct, but certainly perceptive.
There's a long list of areas in which my perceptions were valued. Glaciers, fossils, fish, to name but a few.
Louis Agassiz is a pretty controversial figure. There are some revelations about research he's done and things he did during his career that have raised some serious questions about his legacy. Can you talk a little bit about what those concerns are?
Right. So the biggest issue with him is he has a very troubling racial history of his views. And an argument that we made is his views are not different for the time. There are plenty of racists in the mid-19th century and today. I think what is especially troubling about him is that, one, he is particularly repulsed by people of color and wrote about it to his family in letters, but also wrote articles and essays that were then used to support slavery going forward through the mid-1800s.
Right. So you're asking some really important questions here that I think we're grappling with as a society right now in terms of legacy and whether things that bear names of people who have come and gone, how we should see those names. Can you talk a little bit about kind of how you were thinking about that as you're putting this together?
This kind of came about by accident in that I had talked to the staff here and like asking, you know, if I'm writing these nature plays, like who are the naturalists that I might want to write about? And Asa Gray and Louis Agassiz came up right away. And then trying to understand what's their argument about. Is it about, you know, is it about evolution in a scientific argument that already feels settled, right? But then I started just doing basic research. I'm like, wow, there's a lot of things named for these guys. And how does that feel? And then I remembered the Maria Baldwin School renaming. And like, oh, how does Louis Agassiz feel about that?
Headstones are one thing. But I have streets, an entire neighborhood, schools.
Ah, the school. Is that what this is all about?
Once a thing has a name, it should not be changed. We shouldn't look up in the sky at night and say, oh, there's Mars. No, wait, that's the god of war. Let's rename it something more peaceful.
And because these are men in the 19th century who had a great amount of ego tied up into things being named. That was a big part of the 19th century, of classifying things and naming things. So what does it feel like when we get to that moment where the present has making different decisions?
And there was this kind of fascinating question that the actors ask the audience basically at the end of that play. The widow says he was a good man, and one of the other characters says, was he? And there's no real answer to that. This is a real person with real challenges who did real research that advanced science in some ways, but also resulted in some pretty concerning events.
As a society, right this minute, we're dealing with some big questions around the naming of things, whether it's Civil War monuments or things around Louis Agassiz and people with troubling racist past or who are great misogynists. And we're being forced to confront, as other generations have before us. It's not unique to us. You know, when something has a name, how long does it get to have that name? Is something named after it forever? Or what does it mean in the present when we now know something about the person it was named after, if it's named after a person? You can't unknow that. So once you know something that is now brought to you in the present, you have to make a decision. So something can be named something for a long time, and maybe it's just inertia. It doesn't matter. But once you know something, your society has now made a choice. We either keep it, and that says something about it, or we say, there are plenty of other things to name, people to name a school after. Let's make a different choice. And it's a consensus. And so it's not easy. And there's big arguments. And this play definitely, well, I've already had big arguments about this with people.
I want to ask you quickly about a line that jumped out of I think it was the fourth play, the play about the birds or the bird watchers. One of your characters says, I'm just out in the world trying to pay attention. And when I do, it makes sense. I found that really powerful because I think there is a real power in nature and in going back to nature as a species. Can you talk a little bit about that connection with the natural world?
I feel that way very much myself. And I think that play was channeling a lot of how I feel being here out in the world and thinking about just like even going on the nature walks with the birders or the mushroom guys and just like taking the time to realize that we're part of a greater whole and just to slow down for a second and pay attention around you suddenly changes the whole vibe in this world. Our modern world can be so frenetic and feel scary and we don't know what to make of it. And sometimes you just need to look at your feet and there's a mushroom there and like, oh, okay, things are growing and there's a whole cycle that's going on.
And you end with a play that really is a pretty emotional play. The main characters are trees, and then you have one mourner who comes into the cemetery. I was really struck by the line, life in the aftermath, in the sense that that's kind of what a cemetery is all about. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about kind of balancing people who come to a place like this. A lot of times are here for a sad reason. They're mourning and actively thinking about someone they've lost. And yet there is a sense of kind of hope and positivity. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
I think that sense of life in the aftermath is exactly what made Mount Auburn Cemetery unique in 1831 when it was founded, in that there was no institution like this at all. People were buried in church graveyards that were not at all inviting, not a place you'd want to spend time. And so there was a sanitary reason for creating this, but there was a whole new movement around transcendentalism and a notion of man's relationship to nature and also to death. And this place brought a new way to deal with that life in the aftermath. And that is a continuing theme that stays with this place. And is it the whole design of it? Is it intended to get you engaged with losing yourself a little and seeing life around you?
That was Patrick Gaybridge, producing artistic director for Plays in Place, a theater company focused on site-specific productions. He was talking with Radio Boston's Chris Siderick about one of his earlier works, The Nature Plays, back in May of 2019, which was an eternity ago, before the pandemic and before our nation's reckoning on race. Now, Gaybridge tells us that tonight's play, Moonlight Abolitionists, may feature folks who have long since passed, but still ask plenty of relevant questions about our current moment.
It feels like we're at a moment where people have very strong convictions about social and moral issues in America right now. And I think it is useful to look at historical figures who are faced with some of the most important and difficult moral and political challenges of our history. And that's definitely the men and women involved in the abolition movement. And to understand what it took for them to take action that wasn't always popular, that wasn't always easy. And I think this play asks a question, you know, somewhat indirectly, but also maybe somewhat directly of, you know, what are you willing to do? What are you willing to sacrifice for something that you feel is that important? And that these were real people, and sometimes they failed, and sometimes they were weak, and sometimes they didn't do enough. And that's all part of their story too. I always say my role in writing historical drama, which I do a lot, is kind of to unflatten history, to take out these historical figures and say, look, it wasn't easy for them either. And it's okay if it's not easy for you. They didn't know all the answers, and we don't have to know all the answers either.
That's our show. Thanks for listening to Radio Boston.